Gangs and gang violence are still a major issue in some communities across our region. Why? And what is being done to stop gang violence? Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're going to take this hour to get some information about gangs in our region. How bad is the problem? Are the media blowing the story out of proportion? And what is being done to eradicate gang violence? Let's start with Long Island. Most of our listeners will be familiar with MS-13 and some of the horrific stories about MS-13 violence on Long Island. To explain a bit about MS-13 and what's taking place, we'd like to welcome back Sheriff Errol Toulon Jr., the Sheriff of Suffolk County. Sheriff, welcome back to The Full Story. As always, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ron. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. MS-13 has, according to reports, 10,000 members in the United States. Could you give us a brief history of the gang, where they come from, and how did they make their way to Long Island?
So MS-13 was originated in Los Angeles in the 1980s, and it was as a result of a civil war that had occurred in El Salvador. The three largest areas of MS-13 in our country are Los Angeles, and then we have the DMV corridor, which is D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and then the third most populous with MS-13 is Suffolk County.
So how many of the gang's U.S. members are on Long Island, Suffolk County?
So, you know, since 1997, when the Suffolk County facilities started monitoring MS-13, we've had about 650 members and associates. You know, we have a little bit less than 30 in our facility, but, you know, that doesn't mean that we have everybody that's committed a crime. You know, these members are people that work in our community. They have various low-paying jobs. And so, you know, while they're not incarcerated, they are in our communities, and they are a threat.
So when you say they're working, they have jobs, but I don't mean to be funny when I put it this way, on the side, they're gang members?
No, well, it's not really. You know, that's their work when they're not working. But a lot of these gangs, when you talk about the Bloods, the Crips, and MS-13, and other gangs that are areas affected by, have jobs. They have jobs where they go to work, and that's how they can assimilate into the community and know what's going on, but they still carry out some criminal activities.
What makes MS-13 different? I know there are a number of gangs in our region, but we seem to hear so much just about MS-13. Are they more violent or more dangerous than other gangs?
Well, it's the viciousness and maliciousness that they carry out their crimes. So, you know, they use machetes, they use baseball bats. Most other gang members, you know, will use a knife or use a gun to hurt another gang member. And it's usually, when they commit a crime, it's usually against someone within their own internal organization or a rival organization. Very rarely will you see or hear about gang members targeting innocent people in our communities. And it's generally if a person is injured that's not part of the gang community, it's usually by accident. You hear of a stray bullet that may hit an innocent bystander that was intended for a gang member and not necessarily for people in our community.
I believe you said before there are some 650 members of MS-13 in Suffolk County. Is that number growing? Is it shrinking?
Well, that number was since 1997 when we started actually keeping data on MS-13 in particular. But, you know, what happens is that even as we arrest one or we arrest 10, there's going to be 10 more that's looking to fill their role in the community, because these young men, specifically young men that are involved in this type of activity, are generally intimidated. They don't have any positive role models. There's nowhere for them to go. They don't have a family structure. And so the lure of being in the gang really starts of you wanting to feel like you're part of something, you're part of a community, you're part of an organization, you're part of a family. And that's how they get you, and then they eventually turn you into performing criminal acts.
How much of Suffolk's violent crime is MS-13 responsible for?
You know, since 2000, you know, there've been charges about 40 gang-related homicides in Suffolk and Nassau County, and that's according to the FBI. And 17 of those are MS-13 related just in homicides in Suffolk County. And that's been since 2016.
And I know Central Islip, Brentwood are being disproportionately affected by this, right?
That's correct. And that's because of the communities. And, you know, when individuals come over into our country, they want to assimilate into the communities where they already have a presence. So those are that's where a big presence is in Suffolk County.
Are the media blowing this story out of proportion? Is gang violence in many ways just a good headline?
No, not at all. This is a huge problem in Suffolk County and across our country. You know, I can tell you, I went to El Salvador last April. I was in Los Angeles talking to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department about gang-related issues. And this is something that's affecting us not only on the West Coast, the East Coast, but also in the Midwest in the United States. This is, and it's all types of gangs, and it varies according to where we are in our country, whether they're supremacist groups or they're biker groups. They're, you know, we have MS-13, and as I said, Bloods and Crips earlier. You know, gang violence and gang criminal activity is something that's affecting all of us throughout our country.
This has received a lot of attention from the Trump administration and then Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Are you receiving any support from the federal government specifically to combat MS-13?
Suffolk County is receiving support both from the federal and state level regarding not only MS-13 but all gang violence. So, you know, we appreciate that support because it's the gathering of intelligence that's really going to help us mitigate, stop or solve crimes that have been committed.
MS-13 also has associates, right? They aren't really in the gang, but on the periphery?
Right, exactly. So, you know, what occurs is that, you know, you'll have the gang members that are actually giving out the orders, but then they'll have these associates that will be lookouts for them or do the little things that not necessarily the actual criminal activity, but these associates are involved. You know, if a crime is committed, they're all involved in the crime. But we can say that they have individuals that may, you know, work in a grocery store that may be able to notice certain things that they can report back into the gang community. Or sometimes they may even have a minor fight to see how law enforcement will respond. And, you know, it's a matter of them observing and them also gathering their own intelligence to see how the law enforcement community will react to certain things.
If you're in a gang such as MS-13, can you leave? Can you get out? I remember years ago reading about certain gangs where they say once you're in it for life.
There have been several individuals that have been successful in leaving the gang life. But unfortunately, many, many young kids are so intimidated because not only will these gang members intimidate or threaten them, they will threaten their family members, their wives, their girlfriends, their sisters, and their mothers, their younger brothers, and make them very vulnerable to do the things that they want them to do.
Do they congregate mostly in parks when they're out of their homes?
You know, that's just a misnomer. They do congregate in many areas. It could be the local grocery store. It could be in someone's home. You know, it could be under the guise of another type of organization. So it's really important for law enforcement to really not only interact with our communities. And, you know, you have to remember, you know, especially with the immigrant community, they're very reluctant to talk to law enforcement, unfortunately, because of what may be perceived as their own status here in our country. And so, you know, they might be individuals who can really give law enforcement key intelligence or information about what these members are doing because they're in that community. And so what we really need to do is to make sure that wherever they congregate, whether it is a park, whether it is in a community, and, you know, they are very religious people, so they all do go to church sometimes. And so, you know, where they're communicating and what people see really needs to be reported to law enforcement.
I'm trying to figure out in my head when you say some of them are very religious people, and in the meantime, before you were talking about the murders with machetes and so on, I'm trying to understand that.
Very, excuse me, very ironic that, that yes, but, you know, we have many, many individuals who are incarcerated, both in the local and state prisons that are very religious. And so they believe in what they do, but, you know, of course, while their bodies here on Earth, they're intimidated, threatened, and forced into doing things they probably wouldn't want to do normally.
With the minute or so that we have left, how do you prevent the youth of the future from joining gangs? What do the communities need to be thinking about or doing to keep the kids away from gangs?
So we have to be able to have our children feel free enough to come and talk to us about the issues that they're faced with. Here in the Suffolk County Sheriff's Office, we have a program called the GREAT Program, which is the Gang Resistance Education and Training. And what we do is we get out into the middle schools, and it's a 10-week program that we actually talk to these young men and women about gangs, but not only gangs, but also poor choices and being able to speak to a trusted adult if they feel threatened or if they know that someone's trying to intimidate them to doing something that they feel is wrong.
Sheriff Errol Toulon Jr., the Sheriff of Suffolk County. Sheriff, we always appreciate your time. You're a busy person, and we're grateful that you take the time to speak with us here on The Full Story. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
You are listening to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our talk about gangs in our region, gang violence, and how to prevent youth and the children from becoming members of gangs. Stay with us. We continue our program about gangs and gang violence in our region. Joining us is a former gang member, Sergio Argueta. Mr. Argueta is now the founder and board president of Strong Youth Incorporated. Strong is an acronym. It stands for Struggling to Reunite Our New Generation, and it's a gang prevention agency in Nassau County. Mr. Argueta, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
You, I should mention that you are suffering, as many people are nowadays, from a nasty cold, and we appreciate you soldiering through this.
Thank you so very much. We'll try and get through it. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Thank you. Before you tell us about Strong, tell us a little bit about your own background. You were a gang member, right?
Yeah. So one of the things I like to just clear, you know, just to kind of give individuals a little bit of perspective is when many of us would be asked, if I was to interview you on your life experiences and I asked you what your life experience was during your teenage years, chances are, based upon just human behavior and adolescence and just significant challenges, that you would tell me about things you wouldn't be so proud of, right? Things where you may have succumbed to peer pressure, may have tried alcohol, maybe tried drugs, maybe engaged in some sort of illicit activity, maybe not necessarily illegal, but just something that the rest of society doesn't condone. What happens in communities where there are very little resources, very little opportunities, where schools are failing, where individuals are marginalized, they unfortunately have very little resources that they could actually turn to address those issues. And as a result, growing up on Long Island, one of the most segregated suburbs in the entire country, right? I grew up in a small village of 70,000 people called Hempstead, where we had failing schools, where we had very little opportunities, and where unfortunately there was a lot of violence. And when young people are sort of, you know, trying to survive particular situations, particularly during the phase of adolescence, you tend to turn to whoever you can as a means of protection and survival. And for me, it was a small neighborhood cliques, right? And these were kids I had grown up with, kids that, you know, we had gone to the same elementary schools. And suddenly, because of our skin tone, because we were Latinos, we used to get picked on by the majority group. Now, my community was a Hispanic and African-American community. And so we used to get assaulted and jumped, and we were the victims of violence until we decided that we would band together for protection. And it was only a matter of time before we, too, became aggressors. And so that was a lifestyle that I led. And when I joined this, I was 13, 14 years of age, and I had to lose two friends, and a third went to prison for 12 years of his life so that I could wake up and recognize what I was involved in. And so, you know, that was my lifestyle for about, you know, 5 or 6 years. I was arrested as a juvenile for assault charges, getting into fights. And it was a painful life, and you know, I had issues at home as a result of my activities. I always tell folks I wasn't a gang member inside my home. I sort of became someone else when I left my home. And I justified it by saying that the adults are doing absolutely nothing. The schools are not addressing the issue. The cops at the time were engaged in assaulting members of the community and not necessarily protecting us or caring for what was happening. And so, you know, that's how we justified it, right? But this is no different currently than it was back in 1992, 93 when I was an adolescent. And That's one of the reasons why we continue to lose so many young people to gang violence and gang involvement.
Can I ask how old you were when you, if I can put it this way, saw the light?
I was 18, going on 19, and it wasn't, you know, something that happened so simple. At the time, I had lost a first friend. I was a leader within my gang. I mean, we had 13-year-olds, and we had 25, 28-year-olds. And I was a leader within that group, that family that we called it, right? And, you know, as a result of the loss of my first friend in terms of attempting a retaliation, and this is important for everyone to listen to, we decided to retaliate, and a friend of mine and me and a third friend, we went to a local Kmart. And we walked into a local Kmart, right? And an 18-year-old put a state ID on the counter, and we walked out of that store with a brand new shotgun and a box of shells. This gun was going to be used to commit a crime, and it was purchased within half an hour, legally, right? At 18, we could, in Nassau County, you now have to be 19, soon 21, to buy a box of cigarettes. You have to be 21 years of age to buy alcohol. But at 18, legally walked into a Kmart, put an ID on the counter, and we walked out of that store with a box, with a shotgun and a box of shells. And I was supposed to get together with a friend of mine, and we were going to go, you know, the idea of an eye for an eye. You took my friend's life and this pain and this sadness that we're grappling with. Someone else is going to feel that same pain and sadness. Well, that same night, you know, even though I was supposed to meet my friend and talk about how strange and ironic and painful life can be, my friend left the shotgun in the car. They went to a local venue where they were supposed to go dancing. And as they were walking towards the front of a car, towards the front of the location they were going to be frequenting, a van and a car pulled up, and about 8 to 11 guys got out of these vehicles and started beating them up. And my friend remembered he had a brand new shotgun in the back in the car, and he ran to the back and he grabbed it and he came out, and there were some guys jumping one of our friends, and he pumped the shotgun, shot into the crowd once or twice, and he jumped in the car and took off, and he shot two individuals, I believe the shotgun shells hit. One of them passed away, being our own friend. And he was sentenced to 12 years for an involuntary manslaughter charge. And I had a second funeral to attend. And it was when I started going to see him at the local jail and, eventually upstate prison, and going to the grave sites and recognizing how horrific this life was, that I decided I needed to change. And, you posed a question to the sheriff earlier. The majority of gang members age out of gang life. Unfortunately, they do so after serious injury, right? After catching multi felonies, being incarcerated, and by that time, you know, their life expectancy and life outcomes are slim to none. I was fortunate that the laws weren't what they were now. I was able to get my life on track, right? I barely graduated high school, but I became an honor student at a local community college. I graduated from Hofstra, eventually got my master's. I just got a second master's, if you will, in education. I'm an adjunct professor in multiple universities. And this is the potential that we have in our community to turn these young kids into outstanding individuals, yet we're failing them as a society. And I think that it's so easy to talk about how the kids are failing or what's innately wrong with them and their families, as opposed to what's wrong with a society that's allowing this to occur in vacuums and does little to nothing to actually interrupt it.
Before I forget, congratulations, obviously, on where you are today and all that you have accomplished. Tell us a little bit about STRONG. That's your agency. It stands for Struggling to Reunite Our New Generation.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough where when I went to Nassau Community College, I became the president of the Latin organization my first year and president of student government my second. And suddenly, I started meeting individuals that that look like me, also individuals that didn't look like me from all walks of life, from all various communities, neighboring communities, the boroughs. And what I noticed was that the violence in my community was still going on. And time after time, law enforcement officers and, you know, elected officials that never come into the community to offer opportunities and programs, employment opportunities, they would always host these press conferences about how they had successfully dismantled this street gang and they had gotten rid of them, this street gang, or it was declaring a war on gangs. And it was always a different gang, but it was always a gang of, you know, of people of color. Right. Usually adolescents, usually, you know, claiming victory over these gangs. And eventually you start seeing the rotation where they were arresting the Latin Kings and then they arrested the Crips and then the Bloods and then MS-13. And eventually they'd get back to the rotation and they'd start rearresting and saying they had dismantled these gangs yet a second time. And it was that's when I realized these guys had the audacity to come in here and declare a war on gangs when they have yet to declare peace on our kids. And we started an organization. I was 21 going on 22 at the time. So this is 2-3 years after. At the time, I was actually on my way to Columbia University because I was accepted as a student. I couldn't afford to stay there. So I was there for a couple of months and I got those bills and I couldn't finish. But I went to Hofstra nonetheless. And it was just coalescing, getting these young people I had met in colleges and universities and bringing them out. And we started engaging other gang-involved kids, individuals that come from the community, that have been through it, that have been incarcerated. And we started strong. And as a result of that, we're now on an 18-year journey. I'm actually stepping down as board chair at the end of this month, right? Because, you know, we believe in new leadership. But it was a community grassroots effort by which we believe our kids are the answers to the many issues, not the problem. And we've been able to engage rival gang members, kids from all different types of gangs that are doing some outstanding things. Some of them that have graduated now, some of them that have started their own businesses and are doing some amazing things. And it was simply because instead of blaming them, pathologizing them, calling them the issue, we looked at their inherent strengths, right? And we started addressing the mental health concerns, the trauma, the numerous issues, and most importantly, providing resources, which oftentimes are simply a helping hand. And they've done some amazing things over the last 18 years. We work with victims of gun and gang violence, parents that have lost their loved ones. We have young people that are unfortunately confined to wheelchairs as a result of gang violence, innocent bystanders. And all we do is advocate on their behalf and support them throughout this because we truly believe that the answers to these issues are going to come by way of solutions and programs as opposed to incarceration and massive criminalization and deportation.
Mr. Argueta, we have about 6 minutes left. Do you see the number of youth who want to join gangs increasing or decreasing, especially because of programs like yours?
So, you know, unfortunately, programs like ours are funded at a minimum. We get very little support from government entities as much as we should, especially when you compare their criminal justice budgets and their criminal justice initiatives that are focused mainly on suppression. When you see the suppression funding as opposed to the intervention and prevention funding, you see how it's you know, you're asking people to create miracles with very little resources and opportunities. But we firmly believe that the numbers are always going to fluctuate, right? Depending upon who law enforcement, you know, sees as their number one target at the time, you'll see incarceration rates increase with particular gangs, right? And there's hills and valleys, as is with everything else they sort of decide to do. So right now there's been this major focus on MS-13, and we have to talk about how they became this major focus. And the sheriff said something that was so key that I feel that people have not followed up on is so much of this MS-13 gang violence is intra-gang violence, right? Meaning that they're sort of taking each other out, right? And part of that has to do with the belief that these young people, right, are informants for various law enforcement agencies. And there has been very little accountability or transparency in terms of in terms of having law enforcement say, were they using these victims of gangs as informants? I have yet to see any special or any questioning around those lines, because the belief is that these young people were being pressured into giving information, not being protected, and as a result became violent, became victims of the same violence that they were sort of informing on. And, you know, that's extremely important for us. What we know is that, you know, when the sheriff tells you that there's 30 gang members from MS-13 in his facility, to me, the way it's being described, if Suffolk County is, according to the sheriff, the fourth or fifth location with the most amount of MS, with the highest concentration of MS-13 gang members, why are they only 30 in his facility? Why? That number is a drop in the bucket, especially when you consider it's a county of 1.7, 1.8 million people, right? And if this is the biggest menace to anything on this in this region, why are there only 30? Are we saying that they're out there committing crimes, but we're not arresting them? Because then the issue has to do with policing and making arrests. And so, to me, the number is a low number. It was a bunch of heinous crimes that occurred in a short amount of time, where individuals were coming forward. Parents were reporting that their children were missing. Immigrant parents were coming forward and saying, I haven't seen my child. I haven't seen my son. And nobody lifted a finger until we found out that there were mass graves with close to a dozen kids. Right. But nobody, you know, schools didn't report them as missing. Government entities didn't. Could you imagine anywhere in America where kids were disappearing and not a single social institution came forward to ring the alarm? But that's not the angle from which we're looking at this. We're just looking at this. The biggest culprit is MS-13 as opposed to the biggest societal failures. The biggest culprit is all these immigrant kids, these illegal aliens, as they're referred to, right, on the news, as opposed to saying these were children that were adolescents, may have been making some poor mistakes, but at the end of the day, they were still 15, 16, 17, right? And, you know, that's sort of something that I call to question. So to me, the numbers are going to fluctuate. At most, on any given year, the number that all Nassau County enforcement and Suffolk County enforcement agencies use is that we have close to 4,000 gang members in the entire Long Island region. And membership sort of fluctuates. And these are all, you know, sort of numbers that they project, because we have no real study or way of knowing.
Mr. Argueta, we have 1 minute left. If you're a parent, if you're an aunt or an uncle, you're listening to this and you're worried about your child, your niece, your nephew getting involved with a gang, what should you be looking for? What should you be doing?
Well, I mean, the sign, you know, parents know the signs. If you're worried about your child not going to school, if you see them wearing a particular color, if you're seeing them come home with bruises, you know, they've been the victims of violence, or it looks like they may have inflicted violence, they're getting into fights, things of that nature, you need to reach out to local agencies, local churches, and see what kind of resources are available. I strongly encourage individuals to look at the website strongyouth.com. That's our website. You can get involved with the organization and just, you know, take a look and see if there's any other agencies that are in your region that you could work with to really try and provide services. What I would tell parents is we have, as parents, as adults, we have a responsibility to fight for our children and save their lives and provide for the safety and welfare of all children, whether they are ours or they're in our community. Because we will pay for the investment that we make in them or the results of mass incarceration. And so the most important thing is really reaching out to the social institutions and seeking out their help and looking for these agencies.
Sergio Argueta is the founder, the board president of Strong Youth Incorporated, Strong, struggling to reunite our new generation, a gang prevention agency in Nassau County. Mr. Argueta, we appreciate your time. I hope you feel better, sir.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. Have a blessed day.
Thank you. You too. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Stay with us. We'll have one more segment about gangs and gang violence. We continue with our conversation about gangs in our region, why someone would join a gang, and what impact they have on our communities. Lisa Taylor Austin is a psychotherapist, a licensed counselor, and gang violence expert. Her practice, the Taylor Austin Group, is based in Milford, Connecticut. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've met many therapists over the years. You're the first I've met who decided to specialize in gang violence. Why did you choose this?
There's been two of us that I know of who have specialized in gangs. One was Dr. Lou Yablonsky, who has since passed away. But I was hired to work in a school out in California, and the majority of my students that I worked with were gang members. So it was kind of baptism by fire.
Is it a big problem in Connecticut?
It is. It's more of a problem than people think that it is. We have a pretty high gang population per capita, actually, here in Connecticut.
How large of a number? No one really knows. Is it underreported?
I think that, you know, there's not a lot of focus on it right now because in our nation there's focus on many other things at the moment. And so we saw a very big surge of gang violence in Connecticut in the 1980s. And a lot of those people were incarcerated and went to prison. And so it broke up some of that. But then their children and their nephews and their nieces started a resurgence of that. And then some of the gangs from New York City came up here and kind of merged with some of these homegrown local gangs and created what's called a hybrid gang. And a hybrid gang is when you take a local neighborhood gang and there's also some elements of a more well-known gang with names like Crips and Bloods. Mm-hmm. And those two things kind of merge together and you have a hybrid of some of the Crips and Bloods element. And then you also have some of the neighborhood gang element mixed together.
Are we talking about mostly men or are women also involved in the gangs?
Both men and women, teenagers, a lot of teenagers, but definitely both men and women.
Mm-hmm. What struck me is when you said, well, they were maybe involved with this in the 1980s, but then they went to prison, and you would think that the kids or the extended family would look at that and say, you know, I don't want to do what mom and dad did. They ended up in prison. I'm going to take a different route. But it sounds from what you were saying that maybe that actually influenced them to become part of a gang.
It could have. Some gangs, the children are born into the gang. Other gangs, that is not true. But it depends on what the family expectations and the family norm is. If the family expectation and the family norm is this is what we do, then for a child born into that, it's normal.
Is this mostly in cities or in towns?
Nationwide. It's cities and towns and even rural areas. In Connecticut, it's mostly in cities.
Which cities?
Bridgeport, New Haven, Waterbury, Hartford.
When I read the news and I look at gang violence nowadays, I mostly see and hear about MS-13 out on Long Island. Very few stories concern gang violence in Connecticut. Is that accurate?
Well, it's accurate that the focus is shifting to MS-13, but when you say, is that accurate, what do you specifically are you asking?
I guess I'm going back to my question before about it being underreported because there are very, very few stories about gang violence in Connecticut. It comes up every now and then, but not like I hear about MS-13.
In the last 2 years, I would say that that is true, that the other gangs haven't made the news as much as MS-13 has because we have our leadership has a focus on MS-13 right now. And so the stories tend to, I think, go in that direction. But there are definitely gangs here. There's gangs in Nebraska. There's gangs in California. There's gangs all across the United States, and there always have been.
Why does someone join a gang?
That is a very complex question because there's many different types of gangs. There's entrepreneurial gangs where the gangs exist to make money and they're involved in money laundering, selling drugs, prostitution, weapons sales, anything that will bring money in. Then there's these hybrid gangs, which I talked about a few moments ago. And then we also have transnational gangs, and those are gangs that exist across countries, country lines, so to speak, country territories, and that would be like an MS-13. We also have the homegrown local neighborhood gangs, and then we also have what Dr. Yablonsky referred to as near group type of gangs. And so the reasons that people join these gangs are as varied as the types of gangs that there are. Some people are looking to join a gang to make money. Some people are looking to join a gang for peer acceptance or family acceptance. Some people are looking to join a gang because they have mental health issues and possibly attachment disorder, and their identity is gathered from what other people think of them. It's not internal. And then we also have people who are joining because they've been forced in and they've been forced to join. So it's a pretty complex question.
Just so I'm clear on this, what you were saying is that so some of the gangs could be in Bridgeport or maybe Waterbury or New Haven, but they may have connections with gangs similar to them in other states?
They may and they may not. There's different types of gangs. So, for example, there are some gangs that have connections with the Bloods out of New York City. And the Bloods out of New York City are different than the Bloods that are in California, by the way. So there are some gangs that have these linkages. Latin Kings may have linkages to the New York City Latin Kings.
When we spoke with Sheriff Toulon a little bit earlier in the program, he mentioned that many of the gang members actually have jobs. They get up every day, they go to work at whatever job they have, but almost their sideline job is to be a member of the gang. Does that also happen with the gangs in Connecticut?
Yes, and there's many young gang members who are students who are in our public schools, and they go to school and they're in our classrooms, and they also go to work. I've worked on many legal cases as an expert witness where the defendants either were at the time employed or were employed in the past in legitimate legal jobs, sometimes even. There's been cases where they've even been involved as security officers, military personnel, and police officers.
Police officers who are members of gangs that obviously are breaking the law.
Correct. I haven't worked on a case like that, but they have been in the news.
What about with the kids in the schools? Do other students know that these students are members of gangs? Are they treated differently? Are they told stay away from them? Or do they try to keep it secret?
I think some other students are aware. These are their peers. They probably grew up together. They're possibly living in the same neighborhood, same street together. And then there's other students who might be oblivious to it because their focus, is on something else, or perhaps they live in a different, area of town or something like that.
Do they carry colors that signify who they belong to? Do they have certain signs or something?
That still happens, although around the year 2000, we saw a decline in gang members carrying colors and bandanas and things like that because they were trying to evade law enforcement detection. And so back then, what would happen was they would fly their colors, so to speak, but do it in a more inconspicuous manner. So they might color in the pants pocket of their jeans, but it's tucked in so no one sees it. There's still some of that going on, but it's much less prevalent than it was in the 80s. And what we also see is gang members flying the colors of rival gang members, too. So if they go commit a crime, let's say the Bloods go commit a crime and their known color is red or burgundy, they might actually wear a blue bandana or fly a blue type of identifier when they're committing a crime. That way, if anyone sees them, who's going to get blamed for it? The Crips.
Many times when I've watched movies over the years, gangs seem to, I won't use the word be glorified, but the movies seem to depict that the gang members feel happy being part of the gang because they now have some type of family or social connection. They belong to something.
Right. Some people do belong to gangs for that type of camaraderie, for that sense of family. Some people belong because, just like the rest of the population, they have antisocial personality disorder, or what we know as psychopath or sociopath traits. And so, you know, they're involved in that because their interest is in deviant behavior and they want to take advantage of people.
Have you treated any gang members who did not want to be in the gang anymore? Have you counseled them?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Young people.
Was that successful?
I think it was. I think what they did was they kind of phased out. So they got a job. They got a girlfriend. They eventually perhaps got married or got engaged. They had a baby. And I think they kind of said to the gang, you know, I'm living a legitimate life now, and I really, you know, need to focus on my family, and I'm still with you. I'm still, you know, you have my support in the background, but I'm not going to be running around committing crimes and things like that anymore.
Do the gangs allow members to leave?
Most will, some won't.
I have heard that there are some gangs that simply say, you're in this now, you're in this for life.
That's true.
Do you work with community officials to stop gangs and to prevent them from forming?
No, I don't. You know, as a psychotherapist, a lot of my work is done behind closed doors. And then as an expert witness, I'm brought in after the fact, after the person's been arrested and is facing trial and or perhaps has already been sentenced.
Has the problem gotten better or worse over the years in terms of joining gangs, gang violence?
I think it stayed the same. I think that there's an ebb and flow to this, just like we see ebbs and flows to other things in our society. You have periods of time where there's large crackdowns, and a lot of the key gang members are arrested in these large RICO cases, perhaps. And so many people will go into prison, and that kind of breaks up what's happening out into the street. But then we do see these, you know, little other groups popping up to kind of take their place. And then those, over time, those smaller gangs grow to be the bigger gang in the area, and then it becomes a cyclical process.
Do you find gangs growing in popularity when the economy is bad?
I don't know. I haven't looked at that. It's a good question. It's tough to research gangs. And the reason is because gangs are so fluid from day to day. If you have a gang that perhaps has 50 members, at any given point in time, you've got some of those people who are incarcerated, and it might be a fair amount of them. So it's difficult even for sociologists to try to study gangs. One of the best methods is to be in the neighborhood where the gang lives that you're studying, but that has some safety concerns. And so many sociologists don't want to do that type of research. One of the best places where research has been done is with gang members who are already in prison because they're a captive, literally, group. And for gang members who are involved in therapeutic treatment communities inside of prisons, that's the best population because they're very open and willing to talk about things and that kind of thing. But it's really tough to research and study gangs for this reason.
Does an increased law enforcement personnel presence curb gang violence, or does it make a difference?
I think it drives it more underground, where gang members become more crafty and how to evade police and kind of stay on the down low, so to speak. But, you know, when we have these large arrests with these large RICO cases, that does help to break things up. And what they have been doing over the years is literally splitting up gangs. So, for example, let's say there's 10 gang members who are arrested here in Connecticut. They might send 2 to prison here in Connecticut and send 2 to prison out in Nebraska and send 2 to prison out in West Virginia and break them up like that to make it a little bit more difficult so they can't run things from inside.
You mentioned before that you have talked with some of the gang members on a one-on-one basis. Are you proud of any success story that you could tell us about?
That's a really good question. Yes, I can think of one young man who his family was very entrenched in a gang, and I can't give any specifics for safety reasons for him, but he ultimately became an attorney. He went to law school and became an attorney.
That's amazing. Yes. That's an amazing story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still keep in contact with him?
I don't, but I'm in contact with his friends, you know, from high school. I don't know if they're still friends with him, but they were friends at the time in high school.
With the minute that we have left, what should parents watch out for? And if they think that their kid may be getting involved with a gang, what should they do?
I think that parents should always be on the lookout for any drastic change in behavior because this is an indicator that something, gang or not, is probably not right. So any change in behavior, any desire to want to buy, like all of a sudden out of nowhere, wanting to buy a certain brand of clothing or a certain style of clothing that they never had before, if they have weapons or an interest in weapons, not going to school, going to school but getting into a lot of fights at school where that was never the case before. So really marked changes in their behavior, and I know that sounds very general, but you would be very surprised at how many parents see it, but they keep waiting, hoping it'll improve, and it usually doesn't.
Well, like many parents, right?
Right.
In many different ways.
Right.
Lisa Taylor Austin is a psychotherapist, gang violence expert, and we will have the links to your Twitter account and your Facebook account on our social media.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Today's program was produced by Sabrina Garone, assistant producers Natalie Chafari and Christian Carter. Our digital editor is Carrie Frank. Our engineer is Julie Fredino. The Full Story producer is Ann Lopez. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.